Okay, so Chula Sakaludai Sutta Majjhima Nikaya number 79. A couple of weeks ago we read the Maha Sakaludai Sutta, and it seems that this Chula Sakaludai Sutta happened sometime after the Maha Sakaludai Sutta, it seems. And Sakaludai says he was a wanderer, mentioned a few times. His teacher apparently Vekanasa, whose sutra I believe we're going to look at next week, maybe. Yep, it's recording, yep. And according to the... According to Sutta Central, the Sakaludai Sutta has one corresponding sutta found so far in the Madhyama Agama, number 208. Of course, Madhyama Agama being the scripture of the school of the... Sarvasivada. Thank you for helping me out with that one. Translated by Well, we're not going anywhere. I'm perfectly happy. Translated by define despair. The Majjhima Agama, middle length discourses, Zhong Ahan Jing, corresponding to Majjhima Nikaya, complete translation of the Majjhima Agama of the Sarvastivadin school was done by Sanghadeva, full name Gautama Sanghadeva, in the Eastern Jin Dynasty, 397 to 398 CE. Majjhima Agama Sarvastivadin school contains 222 sutras. Alright, so have you got that? Who's the translator? Sanghadeva. Okay, now we're going to be asking this again next week, and let's see if anybody can remember. Okay. Alrighty.
Did you know the
list of them? Yes. Just no. He didn't do his Agama translations?
Not Agama.
No, he did a lot of the other Chinese translations, but not the Agama. He gives the Agama translations here. Oh, just a what? The
you came from India, China, carried a scroll on the mural.
Yeah, well, here's the. We can maybe have a look at that more sometime. Have a look at the different translators. But Sanyukta Agama was translated by Gunabhadra. Majjhima Agama by Sanghadeva. Dirgha Agama by Buddhaya Shas and Shu Fornian, and Ekotra Agama by Dharmanandi, and edited by Sanghadeva. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Now on that occasion the wanderer Sakaludai was staying in the peacock sanctuary, the wanderer's park, with a large assembly of wanderers. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went to Rajagaha for alms. Then he thought, it is still too early to wander for alms in Rajagaha. Suppose I went to the wanderer Sakaludai in the peacock sanctuary. And then he went to see him, and as usual they sitting there with a great uproar and so on. And we've seen these stock passages in all the last series of suttas. And when we see that, certainly the way that they're formed, this particular chapter has a whole series of suttas dealing with wanderers and so on, and they're all always supposed to be engaging in this kind of chatter. Now, the actual chapter that this is called in, the Vagga in the Majjhima Nikaya, is called the Paribhajika Vagga, a group of 10 suttas, all speaking to wanderers of one sort or another. And not in every case does it talk about this thing of making the wanderers making a big noise and so on, but quite a few suttas do have that. But one of the things that we notice when we're forming the scriptures is that there's in some ways an interplay between the way that the individual scriptures or suttas are formed and then the way that the groups of suttas are formed. So in originally, of course, you'd have these different discourses which were then collected into one group because they had certain similar features, i.e. that they're all discussions with wanderers. But then the fact that they are all there together would mean that they would tend to be edited in a way to emphasise those similar features. So that these stock passages, for example, on the Sakaludayan sitting with a assembly of wanderers making an uproar, may be sort of then multiplied across the suttas, the sort of binding the collection together. And as Venerable Analia notes in his notes to this, it does seem a little bit unusual if these particular group of wanderers were in fact in the habit of just sitting around chatting about things meaninglessly, then it would seem a bit surprising why the Buddha would actually waste his time going to visit them on several occasions. So
is it kind of like having a little philosophy or something, they're all sitting there discussing their ideas on the world?
Well, it seems more like they're just... I mean, the way it's depicted, they're just sort of doing random chatter. But then, interestingly, this particular one is actually incoherent in itself, because once they're doing all that random chatter, the Buddha comes up and says, "What were you talking about?" Sakaludayi says, "Well, don't worry about the discussion for which we're now sitting together here. The Blessed One can hear about it later. Venerable Sir, when I do not come to this assembly, then it sits talking many kinds of pointless talk. But when I have come to this assembly, then it sits looking up at me, thinking, we shall hear the Dhamma that the recluse Udayan will expound to us." So obviously there's an internal contradiction in the sutta, because it first says that they're all sitting doing pointless talk, and then says that they listen to him when they're in the when he's there. So of course it could be put in there to point out his insincerity, but the nature of the discourse itself doesn't sort of lead us to suppose he was an outright liar in that way. It's more likely an editorial problem. That particular passage is not found in the Chinese. So anyway, I'm just pointing out that just some of the influences that cause the suttas to be formed in this way. And so just to remember that these things can go both ways, both because they're similar, they tend to get put together, but also because they've been put together, they then tend to become similar and pieces become shared among the suttas. Okie dokie.
Is it possible to recite them in some of the amazing
Yeah, of course. That's right, and that happens, happens constantly in the Buddhist literature. And one of the remarkable things is there's actually two vinaya rules in the Mahasanghika Vinaya, and I think in the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, where it actually gives instructions on how to make up parts of suttas that you've forgotten. there's a great essay. Actually, maybe I'll just give you one moment. I'll just pop down and get this essay going. Yeah, here we go. an article by Gregory Chopin called If You Can't Remember, How to Make It Up. And here's some quotes. Here's one from the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya. Venerable Upali asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, in the future monks will appear who have imperfect memories, feeble memories. Of course, wouldn't be anyone here who's like that. But if they do not know in which place, village, town, or which sutra was taught, which rule of training was promulgated, how are they to supply them? If, moreover, they were to forget the sutra or the Vinaya or the Abhidhamma, how are they to supply them? Or again, if they were to forget the name of the place or the king or the town or the householder or the lay brother in a story of the past about a king or householder or lay brother, how are they to supply them? The Blessed One said, Upali, those who forget the name of the place and so on must declare it was one or the other of the six great cities or somewhere where the Tathagata stayed many times. If he forgets the name of the king, he must declare it was Prasenadi. If it was the name of the householder, he says it was an Atapindika. If he forgets the name of the lay sister, that it was Usaka, Nigaramata. If he forgets the place of a story of the past, that's a Jataka story, he should say it's in Benares. If he forgets the name of the king in the Jataka story, say it was Brahmadatta. And if he forgets the name of the householder, say it was the householder Sangdhana. If the lay sister, that it was the wife of the householder Porsha Dajata. I'm not familiar with those last two. They must be in the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya Jataka stories. If he would forget the sutra or Vinaya Abhidhamma when he has written it down on a folio, it should be preserved. In this there is no cause for remorse.
Written down on a folio? You must have done the first couple of sentences where he said, forgetting the Abhidhamma, when the Buddha didn't teach Abhidhamma, sort of set the time for the rest of
it. So... And it doesn't have, there's another. There's another passage somewhere else, or it's actually in a footnote to another essay somewhere, that there's a similar thing in the Mahasangika. Is that my name? I'm just an essay. Well, that becomes a bit more problematic, doesn't it? Yeah. But anyway, there's obviously massive evidence within the Pali text that that's exactly what's happened. Like, when I'm sitting here, everyone looks at me, this is what Sakaladayan says, and thinking, we'll listen to Sakaladayan. However, when the Buddha comes, both I and this assembly sit looking up at the Buddha, thinking we shall hear the Dhamma that the Blessed One will expound to us. Somewhat curious that he calls the Buddha the Blessed One. And in fact, this is a point of inconsistency between the Pali and the Chinese, where the Pali has Sakaladayan referring to the Buddha as the Blessed One, whereas in the Chinese, he's usually referred to as Gautama. It's a less polite form of address in ancient India. It was considered disrespectful to refer to one's superiors by just using their personal name, which is a hangover from ancient taboo conceptions of the use of names. In the Chinese version of this particular sutta, it's a little bit inconsistent. Occasionally it uses Gotama, sometimes uses Blessed One. So the Buddha says, then would I suggest something that I should speak about? So this is the classic one, that's what you use when you can't think of a Dhamma talk. Venerable Sir, in recent days there was one claiming to be omniscient and all-seeing, to have complete knowledge and vision. Thus, when I'm standing or walking or sleeping or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and uninterruptedly present to me. When I asked him a question about the past, he prevaricated, led the talk aside and showed anger, hate and bitterness. Then rapture regarding the Blessed One arose in me thus. Oh, surely it's the Blessed One, surely it's the Sublime One who is skilled in these things. But Udayan, who was it that claimed to be omniscient and all-seeing, yet when a question asked by you about the past, led the talk aside and showed anger, hate and bitterness?
who was Nigantanatha Buddha, Venerable Sir. He's the leader of the Jains. In their Chinese version, it mentions actually all of the six ascetics. The Pali here seems to be a bit more plausible because there's no evidence that all of the six ascetics actually claimed to be omniscient, but certainly Nigantanatha Buddha did. Okay, and this is a nice little passage here. Udayan, if someone should recollect his manifold past lives, that is one birth, two births, and so on, with their aspects and particulars, should he recollect his manifold past lives, then either he might ask me a question about the past, or I might ask him a question about the past, and he might satisfy my mind with his answer to my question, or I might satisfy his mind with my answer to his question. If someone with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, should see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and understand how beings pass on according to their actions, then either he might ask me a question about the future, or I must ask him a question about the future, and he might satisfy my mind with his answer to my question, or I might satisfy his mind with my answer to his question. But let be the past, Udayan, let be the future. I shall teach you the Dhamma. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So then, this particular passage is sometimes used as an argument that Buddhism, that dependent origination and so on, is not concerned with the past and future and so on and so forth, but that ignores the context, which is where the Buddha is talking to a somewhat confused wanderer and trying to get him established on some of the basic principles of Dhamma. And wanderer's very interesting response to it. Venerable Sir, I cannot even recollect with their aspects and particulars all that I've experienced within this present existence. So how should I recollect my manifold past lives? And I cannot now even see a mud goblin. So how should I, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses this human, see beings passing away and reappearing, and understand beings pass on, how beings pass on according to their actions, as the Blessed One does? But, Venerable Sir, when the Blessed One told me, but let the past, O Dhyan, let be the future, I shall teach you the Dhamma. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. That is even more unclear to me. So, perhaps, Venerable Sir, I might satisfy the Blessed One's mind by answering a question about our own teacher's doctrine. Okay, so notice that the Buddha's not dismissing talk of the past and the future here in any general sense. I mean, he's saying we could satisfy each other's mind by talking about it, but obviously Udayan's not capable of talking about those things and doesn't understand them, and so tries to point out a basic principle of causality. It arises, the arising and cessation of things according to causality in the present, and even that is beyond Udayan's comprehension. And according to the Pali, okay, so both versions have the bit where the Buddha tried to teach, mentioned about the past and the future, okay, but it's only in the Pali version that it says that the Buddha attempted to teach the dependent origination, a teaching not mentioned in its Chinese counterpart. For the Buddha to bring in a succinct statement of conditionality at this point is in fact surprising, since Sakaludayi would have stood little chance to understood what was meant. And of course he said that he was completely befuddled by that teaching. And the Pali commentary then brings in the explanation that the Buddha knew Sakaludayi would not be able to understand, but nonetheless wanted to deliver this teaching since it would lead to a future wholesome mental impression on Sakaludayi. His commentarial explanation revolves around the concept of vasana, a mental tendency or impression that leads to a particular interest or way of behaving in the future. This vasana theory appears to have come into vogue only with later texts, as apart from a single occurrence of the term, it does not appear to be found in the early discourses. and that one occurrence of it in the is in the Sutta Nipata. I might as well find that. That's where right here.
Okay, yeah, this is a verse talking about the 16 Brahman students of the teacher Bhavri in the final chapter of the Sutta Nipata, the Parayana Vagga. Very, very beautiful chapter, and if you're not familiar with it, please, as Molly Meldrum would say, please do yourself a favour and have a look at it. One of the most inspiring passages in the Pali Canon. This is the introductory section of it, and it's talking about the 16 students who went to or on their way a great journey to see the Buddha to ask him about the Dhamma, and as Brahman ascetics. And here it says that they were all of them were famous and renowned in the world, and they were all Jai Jhana Rata Dhira. They were all practices of jhana, delighters in jhana, wise, and they dwelt Vasita in their former vasana, their former character, or how do you say vasana? Character traits, yeah, something like that. So the idea is that it's a character trait which you've developed through your past karma, which, yeah, character habits, which is informing and enabling you to continue in this life. So it's like a seed which is planted, which has later results. Now this chapter, the Parayana Vagga, the actual meat of the chapter, the essential part of it, 16 questions, is a very old part, and this introductory section is somewhat later, hence the introduction of this somewhat late. Vocabulary there. Okay, anyway, so that's just what this is referring to. So, and according to Jayavikrama, the doctrine of Vasana is apparently alien to early Buddhism. This term does not occur in early Pali works. It's probable that the concept of Pubavasana was further developed into a fuller theory by the time of the commentaries. Okay, so this is a thing which is known in fiction writing as retconning, where you retrospectively make something consistent. And so probably the actual explanation for why the teaching was unsuccessful was that these, maybe the sutta was subject to some later editing, but the commentary can't accept that kind of explanation, so they have to invoke this late Abhidhamma concept of vasana to explain the fact that the Buddha gave his teaching, which simply didn't work. Or, of course, the other possibility is that the Buddha simply wasn't a very good teacher. And we know there's other places where he taught and people just simply didn't get it. So this is always possible. Okay, so where was I now? Okay, so now Satudai is going to talk about his own teacher's doctrine. Okay, what is taught in your own teacher's doctrine? Sache sake acharyake. Okay. Well, it is taught in our own teacher's doctrine, this is the perfect splendor. This is the perfect splendor. Ayang paramo varno. Ayang paramo varno. But Udayan, since this is taught in your teacher's doctrine, this is the perfect splendor. This is the perfect splendor. What is that perfect splendor? Venerable sir, that splendor is a perfect splendor which is unsurpassed by any other splendor, higher or more sublime. I mean, you have to say, I mean, you read it and you think it sounds like a satire, but then when you look at what people, religious people, saying all the time, it sounds exactly like most religious doctrines. Okay, this is a perfect splendor. Okay, what is that splendor? That splendor is the perfect splendor which is unsurpassed by any other splendor higher or more sublime. O Dayan, you might continue a long time in this way.
You say that splendour is a perfect splendour which is unsurpassed by any other splendour, higher or more sublime, yet you do not indicate what that splendour is. Suppose a man were to say, it's a very realistic kind of saying. Suppose a man were to say, I am in love with the most beautiful girl in this country. Then they would ask him, good man, that most beautiful girl in this country with whom you are in love, do you know whether she's from the noble class or the Brahmin class or the merchant class or the worker class? And he would reply, no. Then they would ask him, good man, that most beautiful girl in the country with whom you're in love, do you know her name and clan, whether she's tall or short or middle height, whether she's dark or brown or golden skinned, what town or city or village she lives in? He would say, no. And they would say, good man, do you love a girl that you've never known or seen? And he would say, yes. What do you think, Udayan? That being so, would not that man's talk amount to nonsense? Surely, venerable sir, that man's talk would amount to nonsense. Okay.
I think that
would be very
spontaneous, like,
you know,
saying he's so possible,
And again, I mean, the parallels with contemporary religious discourse is too obvious to need spelling out, really. Anyway, in the same way, Udayan, you say thus, that splendour is the perfect splendour which is unsurpassed by any other splendour, higher or more sublime, yet you do not indicate what that splendour is. So again, you know, notice the Buddha's approach. He's quite direct in criticising Udayan's thing. He's compared it to utter nonsense. Yeah, but he does that in a way that's respectful and that actually engages with him and brings him along with it. And so this, of course, is a classic. So this is what's known in philosophy as a Socratic technique, where you adopt a position which the person you're debating with would approve of, and then you lead them by steps of inference to show them the fallacy or the inconsistency of their original point of view, right? Rather than simply opposing it straight away, you start out by getting on side with them. So you start out by using this kind of example where he can easily agree with you, and then from there you show, well, isn't this the same thing that you're doing? And this is in philosophy known as the Socratic method, and all of Plato's dialogues are full of that. That's basically all it consists of, is exactly this technique. And in Buddhism you find this technique is used, it's not used as widely or in as much detail as in the Socratic dialogues, but it's used quite commonly in discussions with people from other sects. Okay, then Udayan goes on, Venerable Sir, just as a beautiful beryl gem of purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut, lying on a red brocade, glows, radiates and shines of such splendour, is the self surviving, unimpaired after death. Okay, so now we've actually got some content to what he's saying, and his doctrine is, as so often in religious doctrine, it comes down to a doctrine of what is it that survives after death. Evam varno atta hoti arogo paramarana. Okay, this is the splendour of the self which survives unimpaired, arogo, after death. Implicit in this is what seems to have been a widespread belief, which you see reflected in stories quite often in ancient India, which is that the idea that gems themselves have a light within them. We understand that gems glow because they reflect light from outside, but this here and quite commonly is that you find the idea that a gem actually has a light within itself. Okay. Okay. So then, the Buddha says, "What do you think? This beautiful beryl gem, or a glowworm in the thick darkness of the night? Of this too, which gives off the splendour that's more excellent and sublime? Oh, the glow worm in the thick darkness of the night, Venerable Sir. Okay, so here's the word for glow worm in Pali, which you've all been looking for. Yo va ratandhakara dimisaya, is in the darkness of the night. Kimi is a general word for a worm or something. And then the kajo panako. Kimi kajo panako. It's a word for glow worm, it seems. So, there you go. What do you think? That glow worm in the thick of the night or an oil lamp in the thick darkness of the night? Which two gives off the greatest splendor? Oh, well, the oil lamp. Okay, so the oil lamp is the tela padipa. Padipa is the lamp, and tela is oil. Which is the greatest? Okay, and then he says, well, the oil lamp. And then he says, what about the difference between an oil lamp or a great bonfire in the midst of the night? Okay, and so, of course, the name for a bonfire, Maha Agi Kandho, in the middle of the night. So next time we're doing some burning off, we know that we're burning a great Maha Fire Agi Mass Kanda. Okay, bonfire, a Maha Agi Kanda. Okay, which is, the great bonfires. Much more. What's more, the great bonfire or the morning star towards dawn in a clear, cloudless sky? And the word for the morning star, the Osadhi Taraka. Deve here, probably in the sky, perhaps? It is. The word for Deva is the word for sky. The basic root is bright. Yeah, so it's often conflated, like the word Deva is a bright one who lives in the sky, and the Devas are also in control of the weather and things like that, so that these two words are quite, they're very closely linked up, yeah. As they are still in English, because the word for day is still from the root Deva. Yeah, yeah. Day, Deva, divine, Deve, and so the morning star, the Osadhi Taraka, of course referring to Venus, which is more sublime? The morning star towards dawn in a clear, cloudless sky is more sublime. What do you think? Is the morning star more sublime, or the full moon at midnight on a clear, cloudless sky on the opposite day of the 15th? Which of these two, which is more sublime? The full moon at midnight on a clear, cloudless sky, Venerable Sir. Okay, so Tadu Posita Tanrase Vidhe. The moon, Chando. Okay. Then, which is more sublime, the full moon at midnight in the clear, cloudless sky, or the full disk of the sun at midday on a clear, cloudless sky in autumn of the last month of the rainy season? And in India and tropical places, the reason why it's the last month of the rainy season that the sun is compared is because, of course, during the rainy season, all the dust is dampened down, so the sky becomes much more clear in the hot season. There's a lot of wind and the dust comes up and the sky is much less clear. Okay. Well, the full disk of the sun at midday is much brighter. Well then, beyond this, Udayan, I know of very many gods. Okay. And the word for sun here, Surya. I know many gods, many devas, whose radiance the splendor of the sun and moon does not match, yet I do not say there is no other splendor higher or more sublime than that splendor. But you, Udayan, say that splendor which is lower and meaner than a glowworm's, this is the perfect splendor, and yet you do not indicate what that splendor is. The Blessed One has terminated the discussion. The Sublime One has terminated the discussion. But Udayan, why do you say that? Venerable Sir, it is taught in our own teacher's doctrine, this is the perfect splendor, this is the perfect splendor. But on being pressed and questioned and cross-questioned about our own teacher's doctrine by the Blessed One, we are found empty, hollow, and mistaken. There is a certain sincerity about that. Ritta dukcha aparadha. Okay, it strikes me that that particular discourse is very similar to a particular Upanishadic discourse found in the Briharanyaka. I've got a translation of it. Yeah, this is that's a very, very general one, but there's a more specific one. Let's see if I can find it quickly. This is a Gretel text. There's a particular dialogue in the Briharanika Upanishad, which is quite possibly related to this one, where Yajnavalkya goes to visit Janaka the king, and Yajnavalkya had previously made a vow or made an agreement that he would answer whatever questions that the king asked him, but on this occasion he was kind of intent on seclusion, so he didn't really want to answer him. So he tried to keep on evading the king's questions, and the question which the king asked him was, "What is the light of the self?" Here we go. King Jyotir Ayang Purisha, what is the light of the person? And so when Janaka keeps asking him these questions, he keeps on trying to evade them all. So the first time he asks him, Yajnavalkya, what is a person's light? And Yajnavalkya answers, the sun is a person's light, because when the sun comes up, you can go outside and do your work and so on. And this is what Yajnavalkya says. And of course, this isn't what Janaka's trying to ask the question, but he says, when the sun has gone down, then what is a person's light? And he says, when the sun's gone down, the moon is a person's light. Okay, and then he says, well, what happens when there's no moon? Then what is a person's light? He says, well, at that time, fire is the person's light. So notice how this is going exactly the same sequence that we've read in the sutta in the reverse order: the sun, the moon, and now to a fire. And when there's no sun, and there's no moon, and there's no fire, then what is a person's light? Agni, Sante, Kinjoti, Vag. Okay, because, and at that time he says, speech at that time is a person's light. Vag. Because by speech, I'm not sure what that word there means. Jyoti Shaste. I think it means, but by speech you can know your way around, or people can guide each other around by speaking or by talking. Then when there's no sun, no moon, no light, no fire, and no speech, then what is a person's light? What is the light of a person? And finally gets to the question which Yajnavalkya, which Janaka wanted to ask, what is the light of a person? And Yajnavalkya's answer, of course, the real answer, Atmai Vasya Jyotir Bhavati, that time a person's self is their light. And so again, relating to the teaching of Sakaludai, where the self is the light of the gem. And so then he says, what is the self? And gives a succinct definition of the self according to the Upanishads, that is this person, Purusha, who is made of consciousness, Vijnanamaya, breath, prana, and in the heart, something like in the heart, Haraya, is the a person's inner light. Okay, so translate, I don't know exactly how to translate all of that together, but the self is that person who is made of consciousness, And among the breaths is a light in the heart, or something like that.
This can be quite interesting in terms of meditation experiences. In some traditions, that is the basis of the heart as being the source of being the home of consciousness.
And it's, you know, I found it's quite a beautiful teaching. It's kind of a gradual teaching on, and to this idea that looking to that light inside. So, the connection with Sakurdayan's teaching is, I think, very, very close. It's important to notice these things. Obviously, you were showing some of the context of Buddhism, but it is sometimes said that the Buddhist teachings were not aware of the Upanishads. Because most of the time when the Brahmanical teachings are mentioned, it's only the Vedas and the ancillaries to the Vedas which are mentioned as actual texts. And so this is used sometimes as an argument to say that the Buddha wasn't aware of the Upanishads and that his teaching of not-self was only a teaching of the not-self of a limited individual self, but not the higher idea of a self as taught in the Upanishads. But this particular kind of context, as in several others, tends to suggest that the Buddha was quite well aware of these teachings, particularly close relation to the teachings of Yajnavalkya.
I think the Buddha has a higher dependency of identifying
with someone. Something
all the Buddha is not, and only to be close to invalidate it.
That's right, yeah.
So all the Buddha is not, all the dialogue between the Buddha and the
that's right. That's right. Yeah.
So I think we may find a way of the tendency.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's just some. You find in some, for example, some Hindu scholars have tried to argue that the Buddha really taught the same thing as the Upanishads.
Yeah.
You know. That's right, yeah, yeah. Useful to point these things, to know these things, point them out. Okay. Where were we now? Okay. Now, the Buddha then asks Adayan, is there an exclusively pleasant world? There he goes. Ekanta sukho loko, and this phrase ekanta sukha is used to in the Brahmadala Sutta and elsewhere to talk about the existence of a realm after death which is either exclusively happy in this case or sometimes exclusively painful and so on. Is there an exclusively pleasant world? Is there a practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world? Venerable Sir, it is taught in our teacher's doctrine that there is an exclusively pleasant world and there is a practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. So in the translation of the practical way, the Pali here is akaravati patipada. So patipada we know is the way of practice. Akaravati means reasoned or reasonable way of practice. Okay, so what's the practical way? Here, Venerable Sir, abandoning the killing of living beings, one abstains from killing living beings, one abstains from taking what is not given, abstains from misconduct and sensual pleasures, he abandons false speech, or else he undertakes and practices some kind of asceticism. This is the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. Okay, so Udayan's claims here, his teacher's doctrine is basically the first four precepts, or some kind of asceticism, some tapo gunam. Okay, now here's another case where the Pali version mentions doing some kind of asceticism. Okay, in the Chinese, he mentions the need to avoid any other unwholesome courses of action. So I find a little bit implausible that he would equate getting an entirely pleasant world merely with keeping precepts. seems to be certainly not the mainstream position in Indian philosophy.
Especially after the Buddhist mention that you've got such radiance and brilliance.
Yeah.
And you know, they don't steal and they're quite something like that kind of brilliance.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what do you think of Udayan on an occasion when he abandons the killing of living beings and abstains from killing living beings? Does his self then feel only pleasure or both pleasure and pain? Both pleasure and pain. Sukaduki. What do you think? When he abandons what's taken, not given, misconduct and sensual pleasures, false speech, does he feel both pleasure and pain or what? And when he does asceticism, how does he feel, both pleasure or pain, or one or either? He feels both. Well, what do you think? Does the realization of an exclusively pleasant world come about by falling away of mixed pleasure and pain? Interesting question. The Blessed One has terminated the discussion. The Blessed Sublime One has terminated the discussion. And again he repeats, well, this is taught in our own teacher's doctrine, but being pressed by the Buddha, we're found empty, hollow and mistaken. I wonder whether the Buddha's argument is entirely consistent here, because surely it seems that, for example, doing meditation is a mixed, pleasant and painful kind of experience for most of us. Few people maybe have exclusively pleasant experience in meditation. Most of us have mixed, but... Okay, what is the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world? Okay, so now the Buddha's idea of an exclusively pleasant world. And here Udayan, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the first jhana, second jhana and third jhana. This is the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. Okay, of course he mentions up to the third jhana because... the fourth jhana, there's no sukha. So we're talking about the world that's sukha, or the way to realize it, so there's association with sukha. Then he says, this is the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. And then Udayan says, Venerable, so that is not the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. At that point, an exclusively pleasant world has already been realized. Venerable Udayan, at that point, an exclusively pleasant world has not yet been realized. That is only the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. When this was said, the wanderer Sakaludayan's assembly made an uproar, saying very loudly and noisily, we are lost along with our own teacher's doctrines. We are lost along with our own teacher's doctrines. We know nothing higher than that. Then the wanderer Sakaludayan quieted those wanderers and asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, at what point is an exclusively pleasant world realized? Then the Buddha teaches, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain and the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the fourth jhana. He dwells with those deities who have arisen in an entirely pleasant world, and he talks with them and enters into conversation with them. It is at this point that an exclusively pleasant world has been realized. Okay, so this is again interesting. So we're now talking about the fourth jhana. So whether the fourth jhana itself is pleasant or not, it can, in terms of it doesn't have pleasant feeling, but in some ways neutral feeling can be regarded as being even more pleasant than pleasant feeling. But he also talks about discussing with those deities who have arisen in an entirely pleasant world. These deities, thank you. These deities, according to the commentary, by attaining fourth jhana by supernormal power, he goes to the world of refulgent glory, the Subhakinna Deva, and converses with the devas there. And then Udayan says, surely it is for the sake of realizing that exclusively pleasant world that the bhikkhus lead the holy life under the Blessed One. It is not for the sake of realizing that exclusively pleasant world that bhikkhus lead the holy life under me. There are other dhammas, Udayan, higher and more sublime than that, and it is for the sake of realizing them that bhikkhus lead the holy life under me. So what are those higher and more sublime dhammas, Venerable Sir, for the sake of realizing which bhikkhus lead the holy life under the Blessed One?
And, yeah.
Then this, yes, so this is a very valid question. So there's more higher and more sublime states. Goes on to teach the gradual training and, of course, each of the four jhanas. And then this Udayan is a higher and more sublime state for the sake of realizing which bhikkhus lead the holy life under me and saying the second, third and fourth jhana. So what's going on here? Is the Buddha contradicting himself? He says jhanas are more sublime than jhanas. Is there some contradiction here? What's going on?
No. Normally, in the same sutra, he already mentioned about the four jhanas.
Yeah.
With the flesh and the body.
Right.
But not mentioned about the five indolence.
Uh-huh.
No? It's unfortunate that your mind should still have defilement and should still abide in the jhana.
Oh. That's
fine. It's described in the sutra says.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not sama samadhi, but nonetheless samadhi.
Yeah.
Maybe your first one is mitya samadhi and then you have samadhi, something like that.
Yeah, well certainly it's mitya samadhi in the sense that if it's done with wrong view, then if it's done, you know, with the idea to be realized in a, you know, I'm going to get reborn in that Brahma realm.
Not only reborn, but get a flesh and a body.
Yeah, and I guess one difference would be in like that you could translate ekanta as absolute pleasure, but from a Buddhist point of view you'd say, well yes. It's an absolutely pleasant feeling, but it's still dukkha.
Yeah. And he said it is not called exclusive. Here it's generally exclusive collection.
Yeah.
So it's not mixed.
Yeah.
It's not mixed with the dukkha vedana.
Yeah.
Yes, to find some good feeling.
Yeah.
So to find some good feeling, yes, it's still imbued in it, define the mana or not. Because in your first life, yeah, it's not that cry, you enter into your jhana and you have nothing to do with the defilement. But here in the second palai, it's mentioned about the five nivarana. So it's a something different in the Buddhist meditation and the other Anshaya meditation.
See, this the thing is that I would this is really just a literary literary convention. When the gradual training is taught, and as we find taught countless times, that it starts up, the Tathagata appears in the world, blah blah blah, and goes through those things, abandoning the hindrances, all the different states, and then when it finally gets to first jhana, it then inserts a little refrain which sort of encapsulates what the purpose of it. And this is what it's done here. And it does that in just about every teaching on the gradual training. Here's the Samanyapala Sutta. And I got this today. Everyone should have a look at that. If you haven't read it, again, do yourself a favour. This is a great book by Bhikkhu Bodhi, translation of the Digha Nikaya number 2 with its commentary. And it's a fantastic sutta. Probably the my opinion, perhaps the greatest of all the Pali suttas. But here, again, starts out just as in our sutta, the Tathagata arises and so on, teaching, and then the various aspects of the gradual training. And then when it comes up to the question of that started the sutta off what is the fruit of recluseship, the visible fruit of recluseship here and now, fruit of recluseship here and now. And then when it gets to the first jhana, and then at the end of that, then finally the Buddha says, this is a visible fruit of recluseship, more excellent and sublime than the previous ones. And then second jhana repeats that, and third jhana repeats it, and fourth jhana repeats it, and so on. So the literary form of that sutta is identical with the literary form of here, that the refrain, which actually answers the original question, is introduced after the first jhana.
That happens in Samanyapala Sutta. It happens in just about every comparable sutta dealing with the gradual training. So in this case, I would say that this is more to do with simply the following a literary pattern than, you know, I wouldn't necessarily read any huge meaning into it as such. But the basic difference is simply that previously, of course, they were just leading, practicing jhanas in order to be reborn in a perfectly blissful world, whereas here, obviously, there's practicing jhanas for the sake of liberation. So there's a different context. Okay, so then fourth jhana, then purified, bright, wieldy, manifold past lives, the divine eye, and the knowledge of the defilements as the threefold knowledge of te vidya, as the outcome of the gradual training. For the chanting that we'll be doing tomorrow night, I've selected a few of the passages from the gradual training for the chanting. So hopefully we can get familiar with some of those in the Pali. Then finally he says, this is a then the final one, this is the destruction of defilements is the higher and more sublime state for the sake of realizing which these bhikkhus lead the holy life under me. And then when this was said, the wanderer Sakaludayan said to the Blessed One, magnificent, venerable sir, magnificent, venerable sir. The Blessed One has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as turning upright what has been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who is lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to the Blessed One for refuge, and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under the Blessed One, but also I would receive the full ordination. So in the previous sutra on Sakaludayi, he merely rejoices in the Blessed One's words. It's the Mahasakaludayi Sutta, Majjhima 77. And here he's actually asking for the going forth. And when this was said, the wanderer Sakaludayi's assembly addressed him thus, do not lead the holy life under the recluse Gotama, Master Udayan. Having been a teacher, do not live as a pupil. Okay, for Master Udayan to do so would be as if a water jug were to become a pitcher. Do not lead the holy life under the recluse Gotama, Master Udayan. Having been a teacher, Master Udayan, do not live as a pupil. That is how the wanderer Sakaludayan's assembly obstructed him from leading the holy life under the Blessed One. Yeah. Yeah. So in this case, both of the versions more or less agree on that, that he would have wanted to go forth. Yeah, he didn't become a monk. Yeah. According to the commentary, in a previous lifetime, Sakaludayan had encouraged a monk to disrobe in order to be able to inherit his requisites. Yeah. Doesn't seem that he ever went forth. No record of him going forth, doesn't seem. In a past life, but okay. So that's that. Any questions? I wouldn't say mostly. I'd say some of it probably is. Some of the commentary or stuff. There are certain information found in the commentaries which has been confirmed by archaeological findings. There's certain other information which is found in common with teachings of other Buddhist schools and so on. There's other things which, although it can't necessarily be confirmed, is sort of sounds plausible enough and can be taken as reasonable approximation of history. But of course, there's, as well as that, then there's many things which are obviously just, you know, pure invention and stories. So you have to sort of use a degree of discretion when you're looking at it. I mean, as a general kind of rule of thumb, the more kind of mystical or mythological that something sounds, and the more likely it is to have been an invention. But I mean, certainly as a rule, you wouldn't take something that's said in the commentaries as an authority, unless you have good reason to do so. But it's certainly it's interesting that there are a number of quite a lot of things where you find included in the Pali commentaries, where you find a similar thing included in the other Buddhist scriptures of other schools, even though it's obviously a later development, but it's still shared among many different schools.
Do the commentaries have similar views, like in terms of the actual properties compared to Pali?
Oh, they do. They differ on some things, but then agree on quite a lot of other things as well. Yeah. No, not necessarily. No, there's a lot of parallel doctrinal developments across the schools. You know, like the whole idea of the Jatakas, the Bodhisattvas, the Paramis, like Abhidhamma concept, like the Vasana that we mentioned there. Yeah, they're all talking to each other. Yeah, so the ideas get shared around. So the details would differ. But there's a lot that's in common at every stage. And you even find in the late sub-commentaries, for example, you find mentions of things in Burmese sub-commentaries, maybe 7th, 8th century, where they'll incorporate developments in some of the sort of the late Mahayana epistemological philosophers, people like Dignaga and so on, developed certain ideas which then became incorporated in the sub-commentaries. So even at that stage, there was interaction. No, when I said Burmese sub-commentaries, I'm not 100% sure whether that one is Burmese or not, but in any case, in the sub-commentaries. So, yeah, the interaction was still going on till quite a late date, as is, I mean, it's still happening today, so. Yeah. Yeah, the 16 verses are in the last chapter of the Sutta Nipata. Yeah, we've got it downstairs in English. I'm not sure if it's all translated, all available on the web in English, I'm not sure.
Yes, I think the Pali text is not a translation.
There's quite a few translations. I'm not 100% sure if there's one on the web. I would guess so, because Tanisha did one, so it's probably on the Access to Insight. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah, oh well.
I remember reading a composition from Juna Vasa. It really struck me as the jewel of the Sutta Nipata. A lot of this sort of seems to be a lot of crossover way in some ways.
Yeah, this is it's very beautiful. And some of the most yeah, that's suttareadings.net. That's interesting. Both teachings are very inspiring in themselves and also very interesting historically. One of the oldest sections of Pali verse. We've got a few translations of it downstairs. Okay, let's finish by paying the steps.